from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. My guest today, author Stephen Johnson, is an optimist, proud to be one. He says things are getting better thanks to the power of collaboration and peer networks. It isn't just about ideas flying over the internet anymore, he says. It's about progress, real change. Think Wikipedia, think Kickstarter, think beyond just markets and government, beyond left and right. This hour on Point, Stephen Johnson on technology, networks, and the new path to progress. You can join the conversation. Do you see it? Do you believe it? Will networked citizens hotwire progress? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Stephen Johnson, author of many best-selling books on science, technology, the ecosystems of ideas, including Everything Bad is Good for You, The Invention of Air, Where Good Ideas Come From. His latest is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Stephen Johnson, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. It's really nice to be back.
You're an optimist. Boy, it's good to talk to an optimist these days. You're a rare breed.
Yeah, I know. It feels like I'm being outed or something. Whoa. I'm willing to fess up to being optimistic.
No less than an optimist. My goodness. I'm happy to have a little time to spend with you. Hey, let's jump right in here on what you're talking about. Ron Paul, you quote him, and he puts the question this way, and you say maybe there's a third way. You quote Ron Paul in a little front piece here is asking, do we believe in the individual or do we believe in the state? What are you saying, Stephen? Is it a third way? What?
Interestingly, one of the things I've found out since I wrote the book is that I think that was originally said by Rand Paul and then echoed by his dad.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's my mistake. It's not your mistake.
One of those Paul guys.
Well, if you think about the way that we talk about politics in this country and the basic kind of values that we associate with the two parties, we have this tendency to just kind of divide folks up into these two main kind of forms of organization, either the marketplace and, you know, the private sector and the individual entrepreneur, which is kind of championed by the libertarian right. Mm-hmm. And then you have the kind of the power and the safety nets of big government, which is championed by the left. And those are important institutions. You know, I'm a great believer in the power of markets. I'm a great believer in the power of entrepreneurs. I've written a lot about technology where a lot of that has been, you know, in full display over the years. Mm-hmm. And governments obviously have an important role to play. And as someone who kind of comes from a kind of progressive tradition, I obviously believe in that. But what I'm
not
trying
to mention
argue,
the internet itself. I mean, without
not to mention the internet
idea.
Itself, which hopefully we can get to because that's an interesting kind of question. Yeah. But the argument that I'm trying to make is that actually there is this kind of third organization. Or I call in the book kind of a social architecture, mm-hmm. Which in some ways is just as important as the marketplace or the state or big government that we need to be more aware of. And that's what I'm calling in the book the peer network, which is a kind of a bottom-up organization, decentralized. It's not hierarchical. It's, you know, it's not top-down. It's largely made up of a group of kind of diverse people from diverse backgrounds or perspectives who are coming together in a kind of collaborative way and solving problems. And the world actually turns out to be increasingly filled with this kind of organization, and it's a very powerful and adaptive and flexible and ultimately, I think, kind of progressive force for good, hence my optimism. And so the book is trying to make the case for, one, accepting that this is an organization worth thinking about, two, giving a lot of examples and stories of how this kind of organization is at work, and then suggesting that there's maybe a new kind of political philosophy that's emerging that is interested in peer networks first and foremost, thinks there's a role for markets and capitalism and thinks there's a role for traditional top-down government, but thinks that, you know, our first impulse should be to try and build peer networks to solve problems where we can. And that's what I'm calling kind of peer progressives.
That's the new
philosophy.
Let's peer progressives. We'll look at that. Let's deal with the kind of negative image that's grown up in the years of the internet around that group. We'll come to the positive. You talk a lot about it. But I think you talk about an organization. People scratching their heads about what does that mean, a network of people. And then the sort of vision of a bunch of people sitting around in pajamas, you know, throwing harsh comments at one another. producing, going to save the world, really? What's the organization? What's the material positive consequence of collaboration that you see? Give us some examples.
Okay, well, let's start with where you were already heading, which is the creation of the internet itself. So this is very interesting because it's kind of timely as well in terms of the political debate recently. So in the you didn't build that speech. In that speech, President Obama was saying, okay, you know, if you have a business, you didn't build all the kind of infrastructure that helped support that business. And his next line actually was, you know, government created the internet so that businesses could then kind of build things on top of the internet. And then there became this kind of debate. The Wall Street Journal wrote this article saying, well, actually, you know, the private sector built the internet. The government was not nearly as important as people thought. And there's this kind of debate about, you know, was it actually a creation of the market or was it a creation of the state? And in fact, while it is true that government research kind of dollars and funding helped create the internet in crucial ways, the actual organizations that built the internet, that built the web, that built the standards that are behind things like email and a lot of technology that's in, you know, Android phones and iOS devices and things like that, all of them were built by these kind of loose organizations of peers really working almost in a scientific research mode where someone comes up and proposes a new idea and people build on it and nobody owns the ideas. There's no private property in
these. You're talking about the early days of the web when people coming up with HTTP and all the rest.
And HTML and TCP/IP, all those standards. And to this day, no one owns them. And there's a huge amount. I mean, if you could kind of magically turn off all the kind of peer networked software in all the computers of the world, it would be a catastrophe on the level of a world war, right? That's how dependent we are.
It would shut down that communications network. But you say, look, a lot of private companies, AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy, Microsoft, Apple, they all tried to become mainstream consumer networks. So it wasn't fully government, but it wasn't fully market. It was this third thing.
Right, right. And so that's the funny thing about did the government create it or did the private sector create it? Actually, neither did. It was this other kind of organization. And I think that's a starting place for this argument, is to say if it sounds like a kind of utopian collectivist fantasy that there would be these loose collaborative networks without traditional private property or without a traditional hierarchy, if that sounds like a fantasy to you, then look around at the world you live in right now, because in almost everything that is involved, the internet or the web, or almost all the computing devices you have, is built on that fantasy.
The internet's a pretty big deal in itself. What else outside of that world? Can it build outside of that? I mean, because you look at the internet and you say this is not only a manifestation of this, it is the model itself. You know, it is the thing itself, the way, the structure of the web is collaboration kind of incarnate. What about away from that arena, or is it a prisoner of that arena, this dynamic you're talking about?
Yeah, well, that's a very astute point. So there's two levels to that, right? So the internet is itself structured as a peer network. So all the machines on the internet, you know, are kind of peers in the way that the internet is organized. There's no command center. There's no mainframe that controls the whole thing. And then the human beings who built the internet were kind of organized in that same structure, which is this kind of lovely symmetry. So there are a bunch of examples both within kind of the technology world and then outside the technology world of people then solving problems in peer network ways. Let's start within the technology world. Mm-hmm. Kickstarter, which you alluded to in your opening. Mm-hmm. Kickstarter is an attempt to solve the problem of how do you get kind of more experimental work that's creative that hasn't yet found support in the marketplace. How do you get it funded? We agree as a society that creating kind of external funds to support creative minds is something we should do as a society. That's why we have a National Endowment for the Arts. We don't have a National Endowment for detergents because the marketplace is very good at creating detergents on its own, and we don't need to worry about that. But we agree that, you know, that's why we have the Duke Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation and so on. So historically in the past, if you were a creative person who was trying to finish an album or trying to get your art installation done, and you were looking for funds to support it, you either went to big government in the form of the National Endowment for the Arts, or you went to kind of big capital in the form of some philanthropic organization that had been endowed by some very wealthy person. Mm-hmm. And those really were your two big options if you couldn't sell your work directly. Or you starved. Or you
play
worked
on the
nights
street.
And
yeah.
didn't, you know. And what the Kickstarter folks said is, well, wait a second, you know, the world is probably filled with people who would like to spend $10 or $50 or $100 supporting, just for the love of it, interesting creative work, for the kind of reward of being involved. And Kickstarter set up this system where your backers are not investors, right? You can't give them a commercial return on their investment, but you can give them these little rewards. So if you give $10, you know, I'll send you a signed copy of the CD.
And it works. I mean, you report that they have been on track to raise more for artists in a single year than the National Endowment for the Arts entire annual budget.
And they're like 3 years old. I mean, this is just the start, right? So this is one of the stories of the last, 15 or 20 years. Kickstarter's in this category, Wikipedia's in this category, is all these things that, you know, if we talked about them 20 years ago, you would have said, that will never happen, that will never work. Yet somehow, they work.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting the optimistic, hopeful case this hour for positive change, breakthroughs in the way we see things, do things. In the age of networked humanity, my guest is Stephen Johnson. He joins us from San Francisco, author of the new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Stephen, we've got people calling in for you already. Let's get some of their calls. Bill in New Orleans, Louisiana. Bill, you're on with Stephen Johnson in San Francisco.
Hi, Tom. I'm a little distressed that your guest seems to be denying that the government really was the instigator, the seed, the kernel of things like the Internet and much of the technology that has evolved into where we are now with PCs. DARPANET was the start, but he seems to be denying that. The fact that so many of the things that boomed into us in the mid to late 70s came out of NASA, and those things started in the mid-60s. So that to me is a bit distressing.
Let's pick it up right here, Bill. I thank you for your call. Stephen?
Well, let me be clear what I'm saying here. I absolutely believe, and the book makes it clear, that there was great kind of foresight from the government in starting these projects that ultimately led to the Internet. And clearly a lot of the initial kind of bills were paid by government funding. But if you look at the actual people who were creating those standards, and particularly then if you go on to something like the web, which was created outside of the U.S. government, it wasn't like there was an official kind of agency for the creation of the Internet. DARPA was a key part of the story, but a lot of the people were working at different organizations. They were working at universities. They were not necessarily fully on the government payroll. They were just getting some funding from the government for their research. And, you know, the clear thing is the government was much more involved with this part of the process than the private sector was. So I'm certainly leaning towards giving the government some credit here. But I'm trying to point out that the actual organization that was making it happen was much more distributed and decentralized. And it was a lot of different folks working on different teams in different places all around the country, in fact, all around the world. And it was the openness of that process. They weren't just in a single office somewhere inventing the entire Internet in one part of the government bureaucracy. They were distributed all around the world. And it was that distributed nature of it that made it ultimately such a good solution.
You talked to us in the book about how we still seem to see things in terms of heroic efforts of individuals, but very often even that is collaborative these days. Here's a moment that you have some fun with. This was February 2009. Harry Smith and Maggie Rodriguez of CBS had a glowing introduction for Captain Chesley Sullenberger, hailed as a hero of the so-called Miracle of the Hudson, bringing down the U.S. Airways flight in the river by New York City.
Captain Chesley Sullenberger, known as Sully, has logged more than 19,000 hours of flight time in his nearly 30-year career with U.S. Airways.
But it was the 3.5 minutes that it took him to land flight 1549 in the Hudson that have made him a hero.
Made him a hero. 1549 in the Hudson. Everybody loved that story. Sully Sullenberger right out front. What's the story that you saw there, Stephen?
Well, it was an amazing achievement by Sully, the pilot. But what we neglected in telling that story is and this actually is to the previous caller's point, is the kind of long history of collaboration that went into the plane he was flying. And there are two key things. The first is the fact that the engines itself survived the impact of the birds, and one didn't just explode and you know send shards of titanium or whatever mm-hmm. into the fuselage, mm-hmm. But also survived enough to keep enough power going so that the electronic system could go. Now, one of the reasons they did that is that the U.S. government actually has this elaborate testing procedure where they call it the chicken gun, where they throw these frozen chicken carcasses into every model of jet engine that's on a commercial aircraft and make sure that they can withstand a certain number of bird impacts. So that was part of the success of it. It wasn't just the hero pilot, but it was actually this history. That was actually government regulation that was part of that story. But also there was the fly-by-wire electronic system, which was crucial for allowing Sully to kind of navigate that plane down to the Hudson as successfully as he did. And that was there's a long kind of intellectual history of people building this system that started actually in NASA that kind of spread over to Airbus, and they integrated it into the Airbus model that Sully was flying. And he was a great pilot, but he also depended on this incredibly intelligent system that allowed him to get the exact right kind of descent angle going into the river. And so we can't just look at the heroes and the individuals. We have to look at that longer history of kind of collaboration and idea sharing, some of which comes from the private sector and some of which comes from the public sector, and some of it now increasingly comes from these peer networks.
So what's the new dynamic? How does it show up? I mean, we're accustomed to regulation and governments wanting certain kinds of, underwriter laboratory stamp of approval on that kind of thing here on jet engines. We understand tech transfer and evolution, whether it's fly-by-wire or anything else. These things, they may have multiple sources, some public, some private, and they work their way into products that we use. They put us all on a more effective platform. But how do you see peer progressives, this kind of networked collaboration, producing new levels of achievement in, education or medicine or journalism, you name it. Where's the beef?
Let's go to, I think, the first place where this is really starting to blossom, which is communities and local governments. So there are a couple of different examples of this. One of them is actually a program that's been started by city governments around the country. So it's an example of how a government itself can become more peer network in its structure, and that's the 311 services used in many places around the country, the most advanced of which is really in New York City.
And describe those. Not everybody has them yet.
Yeah. And so I'll explain just a little bit. So what a 311 service does is basically it enables people to, they can call in these three numbers. They can report minor emergencies. It's kind of a soft 911. But more than that, they can call and they can ask questions. They can say, I need a battered women's shelter. I need children's events in this park today. They can report problems. They can say, there's a pothole on my street. They can ask about, they need to recycle their air conditioning. They get a live human being who talks to them and can answer their questions. So it's a very efficient, it's almost like an information concierge.
How is it different from an old-fashioned call to City Hall?
Because what they've set up, because in a sense of technology, they've set it up so that the city is not just giving this information out to the people, but the city is taking in all this information and analyzing all of it and looking for patterns, mapping it, looking to see where the problems are, where the needs are. And in a sense, what they've done is they've said the problem of a city is a problem of information overload. How do we figure out what the needs are, where the emerging crises are, where the potholes are? That's a really hard problem to solve, particularly in a city of 8 million people, right? Mm-hmm. And so what 311 does is says, well, listen, we want to decentralize and diversify the number of people that are involved in solving these problems. And instead of just having a bunch of people on the payroll of the government, we're going to deputize anybody who can dial three numbers on a phone and allow them to help us to solve this problem and give them a system and a forum and a kind of a feedback mechanism that's much more robust than anything we used to have. And it means that everybody, you know, the people who are kind of solving these problems aren't just officially working for the government. They're working in communities and neighborhoods. And it's that, you know, that kind of on the ground, local, block by block intelligence that is so essential for understanding, you know, what needs to change and happen in a city. And so I look at something like 311 and I say, this is a great breakthrough in how cities solve problems. And yeah, it uses some technology for sure, but it's actually not really based around the internet. It doesn't actually use the internet or the web quite as well as it could. It's really more about that kind of that simple phone call.
Getting more people more intimately engaged. Is this what you mean when you write about liquid democracies?
Yeah, so in the book, I look at these peer networks and I also try and talk about how existing government organizations and existing corporate organizations can be more peer network-like in the way that they're organized. One great example of this, which is extremely low-tech, is a tradition that came out of Brazil known as participatory budgeting. And it's basically a system where the communities kind of neighborhood by neighborhood gather together. They're given kind of an allotment of the taxpayer funding to spend on projects that they think are important. And so the city, kind of the neighborhoods form, they gather, they talk about their priorities. Do they want to build a sewer? Do they want to fund the public school? Do they want to do this? And they actually get to kind of directly have a say in the projects that a slice of the, you know, kind of city budget goes to support. And it's been a huge success in Brazil, and it's now kind of spreading around the world. It's something like 10% of cities in Europe now use it, and it's coming to Chicago and Brooklyn apparently in the U.S. And what they found is that people, when they're actually involved in the process, it has a huge positive effect on kind of corruption and bureaucratic inefficiency, because people are like, wait a second, you know, we voted last year for that sewer project and why hasn't it been built yet? You know, there's a sense of accountability because people are like, wait a second, we decided what we wanted in our neighborhood, so let's get it done. Whereas if it's just something, a decision being made by a bureaucrat somewhere that you never meet, you're not as aware of what hasn't been built yet.
Stephen Johnson's new book is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. He's with us from San Francisco. Stephen, let's bring some more callers in. Ron in Marlboro, Massachusetts. Ron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was delighted to hear about your guest book, because one of the observations I've made looking at Facebook and looking at some of the videos that appear on TED is there's a growing number of people who are having this exact conversation, you know, about how can we as people, humans, champion the cause of social justice, because it seems there's a growing consciousness that here in America, for instance, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it seems as though neither party has any idea how to minister to the needs of the people. And so people are arising and saying, okay, what do we need to do? Forget them. Mm-hmm. What do we need to do as humans? Let them play their silly games. And the question that comes to my mind as I'm having this conversation is, what's going to happen, what would happen, if a large number of the population suddenly just disinvest their thought energy from the political process and say, to heck with them, we're going to do what needs to be done.
Opt out and what, click in directly to their own sort of efforts here? Stephen, what about it?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, I think that there, obviously, I agree with the caller in the sense that there is this, you know, movement that I think is happening that I'm trying to, describe in the book. It's interesting. It's not quite an opting out in the kind of older 60s kind of way, because it's also so much being fueled by the hyper connectivity of the age of Facebook and Twitter and so on.
It's not opting out of the world, but our caller says, what about opting out of the sort of lockstep of the political polarization of the parties that don't seem to be working? Is there enough horsepower in what you're describing to step in and sort of begin to supplant that?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the interesting question I have is whether, you know, it's, I mean, I'm this book is trying to be outside of traditional kind of left-right politics, but I'm certainly further on the left than I am on the right. And to me, it's interesting to see whether there are certain strains of what the Obama administration has done over the last, 3 years that they're kind of subsections of what they've done that actually connect with the peer progressive agenda. And so I hope that some of these ideas can actually percolate inside of the parties as they stand now. Whether we would need, you know, the kind of peer party to match the Tea Party, I don't know if we, you know, that would. The problem is building a whole infrastructure and, you know, a kind of traditional party structure is almost impossible to do. So I'm hoping that these ideas can kind of animate the existing political conversation as more and more people get interested and inspired by them.
You think a lot about the limits of traditional markets and the limits of traditional government. You talk about Frederick Hyatt here, Jane Jacobs. Describe a bit of that for us.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a really important point. So, you know, one of the kind of canonical ideas of the libertarian tradition, which is something that, you know, for instance, Paul Ryan talks a lot about, is this idea from the Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek that governments are intrinsically bad at solving complex social problems because there's kind of this information bottleneck. The society is too complicated for a small group of people in charge of the government to ever be able to understand everything that's going on. Mm. And so they always have to simplify. This is the kind of crisis of states, is they always have to simplify this complexity of the whole country or the whole economy. And when they simplify, they misunderstand it and they get things wrong. And so there's this kind of information funnel you have to have in a state formation. And so Hayek's point, which is a big kind of central part of the vision of the libertarian worldview, is that markets are intrinsically better at solving social problems because they don't have that bottleneck, because all the knowledge is distributed through the entire marketplace, and you don't have to understand
the whole
thing.
You can nibble in a thousand different ways at a problem.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there are more minds involved in the problem, so it's more innovative. And so people can come up with, you know, when there's a Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak in a garage somewhere, they don't have to have any power really inside the system. But if they come up with a good idea, it can circulate and attract consumers, and the market will attract.
So there's the Hayek ideal, but you say, but wait a minute.
Well, the point, part of this is I think that that's true. I think that is a problem with governments, and that's why I think decentralized solutions are often really good ones and really innovative ones. The problem is that not all social problems can be solved by marketplaces or corporations, and there are places where you're not necessarily going to make enough money to incentivize private sector initiatives. So – what I'm arguing is that when there are holes in the marketplace, when there are things that the market isn't solving on its own, whether it's building roads or building the internet or providing education or all these other things, what the government should be doing is supporting and encouraging peer networks to solve those problems, because peer networks are equally decentralized and they don't fail the Hayek test in a sense. The way that, you know, traditional bureaucracies do. So there's part of the libertarian tradition that I buy and I think is important, but I think it's a more complicated and bigger story.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting a hopeful case for positive change today, breakthroughs in the way we see things, do things in the age of networked humanity with Stephen Johnson. He's author of the new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Kind of a third way here, maybe modeled on the internet, but leaping right on beyond that as he describes it. Stephen Johnson joins us from San Francisco. Casey's with us right now from Chicago. Casey, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Stephen. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a CEO of a startup here in Chicago, and I think one of the lessons that I've learned in the last year is there's a new movement in the startup world they call lean startups, and it's sort of taking the world by storm. And one of the things that we learned from that is it's really critical in the early stage of a startup, you're trying to solve a very local problem, as Stephen just mentioned, and it's really critical to get that traction with that problem that you're trying to solve, but it's also equally important to try to get to scale. And that's always a big challenge for a small company without resources. And one of the ways that we do that is by trying to build on existing networks. Now, in the internet world, that might be building it on Facebook or on a different network and kind of riding their size and scale to get to a big group of people.
Yeah.
I think there's a great opportunity for public-private partnerships here to sort of hack, you know, government and reinvent government, because in Washington, there's obviously this crisis of confidence in the, you know, effectiveness of government to solve problems. And yet most of the problems that people get really worked up about are ones that startups can't solve and private sector can't solve. They're external to the market. And you need that collaboration. And it's really critical that we try to sort of scale those initiatives. So I think the Obama administration has actually done something innovative around unleashing data and trying to get people to build on the platform of data. So our startup could not be possible if, you know, Reagan hadn't deregulated and opened up GPS data. And now Google Maps exists. And now we can plug an API into our app and build something on the fly that would have taken years to build as a private company on our own.
So, Casey, give us an example beyond the private sector opportunity that you're pursuing built on that. What if it were a public-private partnership, like what? Are you talking about, I mean, you've got big education issues right now in Chicago with the strike. Are you talking about schools, or where do you see the opportunity?
Well, I see in any place where, as Stephen alluded to, I think there are problems that government can't solve in its entirety by itself. The private sector can't solve in its entirety by itself. It's probably those things that are external to the market that are public goods. So education is one. Clean energy is probably one where you need some combination of government R&D, private sector commercialization, and some true startup innovation to go create that next Apple computer of clean energy, right? So I think it's a combination of all three, but there's also just a way to reinvent governance. Like the other day I was looking at, there's a new open markup platform for basically crowdsourcing bills, so legislation. So there's all these bills that go through different, you know, units of government that nobody ever reads and nobody has a way to participate in. And that's another way to invent government, so it's efficient, it actually reaches local people. So I think you can use technology to involve people and get them to participate and actually increase confidence in government to do the right thing.
Casey, I'm so glad to hear from you from Chicago. Stephen Johnson, respond. What's the lattice work for this look like? And make it real for us with whatever examples you can give us.
Yeah, what a great set of observations. Thanks, Casey. About 15 things I would say in response to that. Let me give you one specific example of a proposal that comes from Larry Lessig, the wonderful law scholar, and a few other folks. One of the biggest problems we've got right now in the existing government system is the campaign finance system is so messed up. Mm-hmm. And it's a betrayal of Hayek in a way, and it's a betrayal of pure progressive values, because you have a very small number of people with very large sums of money who are able to have a wildly disproportionate impact on our political leaders, whether it's big unions or big corporate entities or just super wealthy people. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to have that small, tiny elite that are having this disproportionate impact, because that's bad in the Hayek libertarian perspective on things, and that's bad on the progressive, pure progressive perspective on things. So the old way to do this would say, okay, well, let's just have public funding of elections, and we'll take kind of individual, just distribute taxpayer dollars kind of randomly, and the government will decide how to fund these elections. But that's also a betrayal of pure progressive values.
It didn't really work. There's so many ways around it.
Yeah. So what Lessig and some other folks have proposed is this idea of kind of democracy vouchers, which is, I think, a beautiful example of how this would work in a pure progressive way, which is to say, let every person in the country kind of spend 50 of their tax dollars on a candidate or on a party. And if they want, they can spend an additional $100 on top of that, with their own kind of hard-earned money that they have, in addition to the money that they're paying into the tax system. And if they don't specifically allocate it, it goes to their party that they're registered with. And if they don't register with the party, it goes to support the overall infrastructure of holding elections and things like that. But it gives people the opportunity to actually kind of spend this money that would otherwise go for taxes to support the campaign system. And if you signed up as a politician to accept that money, the only terms would be that you would have to kind of renounce all other, you know, outside funding. If you took that pool,
so that would redemocratize the funding.
It would effectively, again, in the language we were using before, mm-hmm. it would diversify the number of people who were kind of part of the campaign funding process. So you would still have people able to choose the candidates they wanted to support, but you wouldn't have that bottleneck, that small, you know, group of folks who were having a wildly disproportionate impact. And so you would get a much more, I think, balanced and much more effective way of supporting candidates.
Not that bottleneck that you're right. James Madison warned so vividly about in the Federalist Papers, the tyrannical nobles of the system. What about Casey's notion of crowdsourcing even legislation, where you can really get into working on problems? I mean, can you picture that sort of collaborative markups of legislation? Is that chaos or is that the future?
I mean, it's just as crazy as a globally, collectively authored encyclopedia would have seemed 20 years ago.
Right.
But you know, another example that Casey was kind of alluding to, too, is there are these wonderful kind of open government challenges, prize-back challenges, where the government – and this happens on a local level and a federal level – where the government says, hey, here's all this data. Come and invent something useful with this data, you know, create an app that helps people, you know, analyze where their taxpayer dollars are going or figure out local crime data in their neighborhood. And we'll give a, you know, small monetary reward if you create a, you know, useful, app or utilization of that data. And it turns out to be an incredibly efficient way to get people who aren't, again, on the payroll of the government to contribute to making governments more efficient and more useful. And you put up a contest like this and you'll get, you know, hundreds of applicants who are, you know, kind of sending in these working apps that can then be freely shared. And the overall cost of the program is, you know, $50,000 as opposed to, you know, a traditional government procurement program, which would spend, you know, $5 million to get something like that done.
If a government's
so it makes
free
government more
to open up in that way.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's a kind of inverted version of the old reinventing government from the days of Al Gore. It's not about making government more efficient on the inside. It's about bringing in people from the outside who, you know, are just ordinary citizens or just peers, not, you know, actual, you know, kind of government employees. But by allowing those minds to contribute to the problems that government is trying to solve, the government actually gets more efficient. And there's this broader civic good of people being more engaged, of feeling like, hey, I can help solve these problems, and problems can be solved if we put our minds to it. It's not some intractable, endlessly, kind of waterlogged process where you can't get anything done.
Let's get a call from Bloomington, Illinois. Will is calling. Hi, Will. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Well, I want to get your guests' opinions on this. The one word I've not heard mentioned throughout this whole conversation is anarchism. And that's what this strikes me as, this whole flat, horizontal, direct democracy, direct innovation. It's without rulers, without leaders, a collective effort.
You hear anarchy. Do you hear that in a positive or a negative way, Will?
Well, and that's an interesting point. The word means without rulers. Most people hear it used to describe some fool downtown throwing a trash can through a Starbucks window.
Yep.
But that's not what it is. It's a system of governance.
Yeah, it's a very interesting and important point. I think what the caller effectively is kind of referring to is really kind of the 19th century tradition of anarchism. Anarchism kind of then became kind of more diffuse category and got associated with things that were more about chaos than they were about a decentralized system of governance. That is one of the great ironies of the internet, is that parts of it are kind of structured in that anarchic way. And it may ultimately be the, you know, the single most important triumph of that political philosophy to date. And it's this amazing kind of functioning anarchy without traditional leaders, and it works, and it creates a platform that then traditional states and traditional corporations can work on top of. The difference, I would say, is that there was a lot of in the 19th century anarchist tradition. There was a strong belief that all forms of private property should become obsolete. And so it was in that sense tied to, you know, kind of the kind of Marxist ideas of that period as well, although it didn't believe in a top-heavy state the way the Marxists ultimately did. So I think there are roots in that 19th century anarchist tradition, but I think that pure progressivism has lots of room for private property and, in fact, is a great believer in markets. When markets work well, they actually are distributed networks and decentralized networks the way that I said. It's in some sense our problem with the market is that corporations themselves are too hierarchical. And there's an important argument to be made that, you know, if you look at the history, for instance, of Silicon Valley, you know, the one part of the economy where we agree that it's thriving and innovating and doing a great job, those corporate structures that all those companies have are far less hierarchical than traditional capitalist structures over the history of capitalism, basically. Well, they're much more participatory, much more egalitarian in the way they make decisions. They share their wealth in a much more kind of even distributed way. And they've outperformed the rest of the economy. So, you know, I think the corporation should become more peer network in their structures. And in the long run, that's probably good business for them.
So they've changed structure to a significant extent. They're much less hierarchical. I mean, if this kind of third way grows up in between left and right or on its own beam, if it really flourishes, what does it mean about more generally how the corporate world would look, how the government world would look? I mean, do you have to get into sort of tinkering with the very structure of our government, even our representative bodies at some point? Instead, you've got, I don't know, people leaning into great issues of the day on their keyboard at home, the Senate of the mass.
You know, one of the reasons I write books like this is so that people who are smarter than I am can come along and solve those really challenging problems. But I think we have an opportunity to, you know, make all those institutions more participatory. I mean, the Tim O'Reilly, the great kind of tech visionary and entrepreneur, talks about the internet and a lot of these systems having the architecture of participation, that they just invite participation much more than traditional older media. And I think we want to see the architecture of participation flourish inside of corporate organizations and inside of government organizations. And the gift we have at this particular moment is, one, we have technology that helps that. But it's not just about the technology. It's not just about, oh, we just put everybody on Facebook and it'll work out for the good. You know, it doesn't really work that way. What we have is an understanding of how these systems work now, from the role models of the internet and Wikipedia and Kickstarter. And we can thus, you know, use that knowledge to build systems, sometimes entirely low-tech systems, sometimes just people getting together in a room somewhere and talking about how to make their neighborhood work better. That is the core of my optimism, my bizarre optimism, is that, you know, we have these kind of parallel gifts right now of tools and an understanding that allows us to kind of experiment with these systems now. And I think there's a lot to be done with them that we haven't tried yet.
I was surprised late in the book to read, you're sort of climbing the ladder of challenges with this notion of peer networks and peer progressivism. And then I come to the point in the book, deep in it, where you say it may well be that certain pressing problems, climate change, military defense, require older approaches or institutions. Is that admitting some kind of fundamental flaw here? I mean, if this is so great, but it can't take on what may be the most important, problem we're facing, climate change, what's that say about the efficacy? You're going to roll out old-fashioned government to do that? Is that really the outer bound of your peer network power?
Yeah, it's a funny sentence. It all depends on how you read the "it may well be." You know, I was trying to, what's the difference of it is? I was trying to just set some, you know, because the book is so optimistic and it's so, I mean, provocatively utopian. I mean, I say it a couple of points in the book. It's like we need to have utopian thinking out there, if only so we have things to steer towards, right? We may never get there, but we want to just kind of have some lodestar that we can, you know, set sail towards. But I wanted to make it clear that I don't necessarily think that every single thing ever will be solved by this kind of organization. And so, you know, because I don't have a clear path towards a solution for global warming coming from peer networks, I put that on the list. And there probably is, you know, I think military structures, probably have to be more command than a lot of other social architectures in society.
Maybe networks obviate the need. Maybe they obviate the need for those somehow. Maybe they work around the war part here. But it's a little distressing to think, gosh, if the big one can't, the climate, you know, can't be addressed by this, then we're back in the same satchel we've been sort of stalled in for a while.
Yeah, I would love to just see folks take these ideas and run with them and solve problems that big. So I only said may.
right. It may. And that leaves open the possibility maybe it will be just the way it gets done. Stephen Johnson's new book is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. You joined us today from San Francisco. Stephen, great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, I really enjoyed it.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale-Rosen, Eileen Amata, Mark Kilstein, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Charlotte McDonald and Arjun Singh, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.